The following Dharma talk was given at Boundless Way Zen Temple in Worcester, Massachusetts.
This is case number 15 from the Book of Serenity. Yangshan thrust his hoe into the ground. Guishan asked Yangshan, "Where have you been?" Yangshan said, "In the rice field." "How many people are in the rice field?" Yangshan thrust his hoe into the ground and stood with his hands clasped at his chest. Guishan said, "Today many people are cutting reeds on South Mountain." Yangshan placed his hoe on his shoulder and immediately left. So the Book of Serenity is a 12th century koan collection from China. And this particular koan concerns two teachers, although at the time they're not both teachers, but two great teachers who lived in the 8th and 9th century in China, Guishan and Yangshan. A little bit about them. Guishan was a Dharma heir of the great 8th century teacher Baizhang, and that's worth bearing in mind. Baizhang we often associate with the Linji Rinzai tradition in Zen because of the line that goes from Baizhang through Wangbo to Linji or Rinzai. But Baizhang also had other Dharma heirs, including Guishan, Guishan and his disciple Yangshan ended up starting a different school of Zen. In fact, the first of the five great Chinese schools of Zen, the five great Chan schools, which was Guishan and Yangshan, the Guiyang school, and of course also the Linji school and the Saodong school, and those two are still alive and well. The Guiyang school did not last for many more generations, but an important moment in our history, really important. And this koan, as I've been sitting with it, walking with it, playing with it, working with it, has been really speaking to me of the roots of our practice as we do it now. It feels like going back to the beginnings of a important part of our Zen DNA. And before I go into that, something I'd like to say about the two speakers, Guishan and Yangshan. At this point, Guishan's chief disciple, later a great teacher in his own right, is that sometimes in our koan collection, in a given koan, there'll be a big gap between teacher and student. A new monk shows up at the monastery and says to Zhaozhou, "Please instruct me." And Zhaozhou says, "Have you eaten your rice gruel?" And the student says, "Yes," and Zhaozhou says, "Then wash your bowls." We feel the big difference between teacher, a seasoned, great, eminent teacher, and a new, fresh-faced monk. And then other koans, the two speakers are closer together, but there's often a kind of conflict involved. And these can be stories of Dharma combats. But sometimes the two speakers are very close together in terms of their realization. And it's less a Dharma combat than a kind of Dharma play. And each affirms the other in the course of the story. And that's how this one feels to me. So Guishan asks Yangshan, where have you been? So maybe just checking up on him, but probably not. Where have you been? Where are you coming from? Sometimes we use that colloquially. Where is this coming from? Just where are you coming from? What are you manifesting right now? What are you bringing to this encounter of many encounters? These two spent years together, lots and lots of meetings. So where have you been this time? Where are you right now? Where are you coming from? Guishan opens this dialogue. And Yangshan replies, in the rice field. So other translations I've looked at say, from the fields or from the field. I like the fact that this one specifies rice field. It opens up a lot for us, I think. I mentioned that Guishan was a student of Baizhang. And Baizhang is said to have been the first of the great Chan teachers to have a Chan monastery. Before that, Chan students, Zen students, were in monasteries that were shared with other Zen sects, other Zen schools. But Baizhang established the first Chan monastery in the mountains, and he gave it a kind of code that became the master code for Chan monasteries and later Zen and Korean Seon monasteries to come. And it persists in our American Zen centers and temples today. And one of the big features, one of the big important features of Baizhang's code and Baizhang's practice, monastic practice with his monks, was that the monks worked. And this was a huge departure from Buddhism in India. Of course, Buddhism had come to China from India. And in India, the monks lived by begging. And this was not because they didn't like to work, it was because it was felt that working would just generate lots of karma that would then have to be dealt with in lifetime after lifetime. And so the monks did no work, they begged. And then if you weren't lucky enough to be a monk, then you gave food to the monks, you endowed monasteries, you paid for stupas to be built. You did all kinds of good works with the hopes that you would be born in some life to come, hopefully not too many away, as a monk. And then you could become enlightened. You could enjoy great realization. But in China, great change. Work was no longer seen as a kind of impediment to being a person of the way. Work became part of one's practice. So the monks grew their own food. Another reason that this was important is that it meant that the monasteries, the Chan monasteries, didn't need to be stationed near villages or towns or cities where there would be people to beg from, but they could be set up high in the mountains, where you would only be able to beg from wild monkeys and tigers and bears who don't tend to be very generous with their food. And it meant that, therefore, that the Chan monasteries could be remote from politics, from the seats of government, and have some peace and independence in a time that was very, very unruly. If you don't like American politics now, you really would not have wanted to live in ancient China at a time of warring dynasties and revolts and mass slaughter and mass famine. And the Chan monastery in the mountains was removed from some of that. And so work practice, what came to be called in Japanese samu, what we did a little while ago here in the temple, work practice became an important part of a monastic day. And so Yangshan has been in the rice field. I said that I was happy that it's specified in our translation as rice field, because rice is so important. Rice is the main food in a Chan monastery or in a Zen monastery in Japan. The biblical tradition talks about bread as the staff of life, but in Asian cultures, most Asian cultures, it would be rice. Rice as the fundamental food, the food that represents all nourishment. And so what more important activity could there be for your samu than growing rice so that the sangha can live, so that the sangha can persist, so that everyone can do their practice without fear of starvation. And, you know, we could get allegorical with this. There's at least one koan that talks about giving food as a kind of dharmic, kind of teaching the Dharma, something like that. But I don't think we want to. Yangshan was growing rice. That's what he was doing. That's what's important here. So here we have the tradition of Baizhang, who said, a day of no work is a day of no eating. Here we have the tradition of Baizhang unfolding through his disciple Guishan, his Dharma heir Guishan, and now Guishan's Dharma heir Yangshan, and extending all the way to us. Really important, too, in the way that this incorporation of work into the Zen way, into the monastic Zen way, narrowed the difference between lay practitioners and ordained practitioners. It wasn't that you had lay people that worked and ordained people that didn't, but ordained people worked and lay people practice. And one of the appeals of Zen in China was that you didn't have to wait for another lifetime to follow the Zen way and to become enlightened, to realize your Buddha nature. You could do that even if you were a lay person who had to work in the fields or in some other way. And so we have great Chinese lay practitioners like Layman Pang, who made baskets and or bamboo utensils with his family, or earlier Mahasattva Fu, who was a farmer, and no sense of them as being inferior, lesser. And again, even the ordained monks in monasteries did some work. And you can see how this opened the door to where Zen eventually went, so that in Japan, not that long ago, but before Zen came to America, priests began marrying and having families. And now in American Zen, we don't think twice about our ordained teachers, our priests, having families, having day jobs. Not a problem. This does not get in the way of our practice. And those of us who are lay practitioners don't have to see our jobs as a burden. We can't wait to get out from under. But we can make our work activity, whatever it is, part of our practice, just as we do in samu at the temple. So samu isn't something we do because we need to keep the temple clean and we don't want to pay other people to do it. It's something we do because this is a part of our practice that has its roots in ancient China, that goes back to the beginnings of Chan. So, Yangshan in the rice field, that's where he's coming from. And then Guishan asks him something that seems like just a factual question. How many people are in the rice field? And the mind at that point kind of goes, yeah, how many people? Was Yangshan working alone? Did he have a whole crew? That's not where Yangshan's mind goes. How many people are in the rice field? What is Guishan really asking Yangshan? What is Guishan probing for? What's happening now in this very spare and yet very dynamic and rich brief interview? How many people are in the rice field? We were talking a couple weeks ago in a, I think it was a senior, no, I think it was an assistant teacher meeting. We were talking, David Roshi led us to talk about the first of the Bodhisattva vows, beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And I think the invitation was, how would you talk about that? And what came up for me right away was the importance of numberless. Beings are numberless. I vow to free them. And how Zen is not quantitative. We don't say there are 8 billion people on this planet. I vow to free them. Beings are numberless does a couple of things, and one is it means that our bodhisattva activity never ends. It is something that we do all the way through our lives. And it also means that we don't have to keep count. We don't have to keep track. We don't have to hand in annual reports listing how many beings we've saved. We don't compete with each other over numbers. And this non-quantitative nature extends to so much of our practice. And of course, it's in such distinction to this capitalist economy that we live in here in 21st century America, with its emphasis on numbers, sales figures, numbers of shares, you know, quantity of billions or trillions of dollars or tens of dollars, depending on who you are. I remember in the part of what became a bit of a plague for my life as a college teacher, as a university teacher, an academic, was that at a certain point, boards of overseers and administrators became enamored of these quantitative ways of measuring what we did in the university, which, you know, if you're in the liberal arts, is so perverse. That's not what the liberal arts were ever supposed to be about. But they came up with this formula that was called FTEs. I'm not even sure what that stood for, full-time equivalents or something. And you were supposed to, and they wanted department chairs to add up everybody's contact hours and classroom hours, numbers of students, and it was all supposed to reach a certain number, and if it didn't, oh, then you were in trouble, then the department was in trouble, you lost faculty, you lost whole departments. It was really a way of streamlining some of the most beautiful parts of the university out of the university. And so if you didn't have enough people studying Portuguese or Korean, you no longer taught Portuguese or Korean, and so on. And how sad, you know, what a sad way to think about a palace of learning. And so even places where you would think it wouldn't penetrate, these quantitative ways have penetrated, but not here. And I'm talking about our culture, but I don't think that ancient China didn't have its quantitative issues as well. By the 8th century, China had a census. It had a taxation system. I'm sure that there were all kinds of quotas and things in place. And the Chan tradition did not want to have anything to do with that, just as we here don't want to have anything to do with numbers. Those of us who are involved in planning and organizing and scheduling Sesshin, we talk about numbers at a certain point. We do sometimes. We need to know how to arrange the zendo and how many Sesshin a year to hold and how much food to get. But once we're here, we don't think about numbers. And I've noticed this in myself. I noticed it last night, that every Sesshin I've ever been to here in the temple, I've thought that the number of people at the Sesshin was the perfect number. And it didn't matter if it was 47, which, believe it or not, we once did, or a handful. It's always the right number. The quantitative parts just fall away as we move into our practice together, and it becomes about the value of each moment together, which can't be measured. So how interesting that Kuaishan should ask Yangshan how many people are in the field. And here's how Yangshan replies. Yangshan thrust his hoe into the ground and stood with his hands clasped at his chest. What a beautiful gesture. And here we are, for me, at the heart of this koan. Yangshan thrust his hoe into the ground and stood with his hands clasped at his chest. So, what is Yangshan up to? Right? He certainly doesn't say, oh, well, there were 17 people, I think. But then one person left, so there were 16 by the time I left. He thrust his hoe into the ground so that he'll stand up and he can place his hands clasped at his chest in a kind of shashu-like position and stands there. I want to read you the editor's, Wan Song's, introduction, not the recent editor, but the ancient editor, Wan Song, who edited this collection, The Book of Serenity. I want to read you his little introduction. It's just a few sentences. Knowing before speech is called silent discourse. Spontaneous revelation without clarification is called hidden activity. Knowing before speech is called silent discourse. Spontaneous revelation without clarification is called hidden activity. Saluting in front of the gate, walking down the hallway, this has a reason. What about dancing in the garden or wagging the head out the back door? Yeah, what about that? So this is Wan Song, reminding us that in the Chan tradition, in the Zen tradition, there is teaching with words and there's teaching without words. And so teacher and student, in a way, shift roles at this moment in the koan, at least for me they do. When Yangshan thrusts his hoe into the ground and stands with his hands clasped at his chest, what is the message here? And we know that Yangshan is doing this with his entire self, wholeheartedly, nothing held back. This is Yangshan fully revealed, or as we sometimes hear in the koans, completely exposed, fully exposed. When we were reading during the sutra service, when we were reading Yang Jia's Song of Realizing the Tao together, I chose it kind of at random, but then these lines leapt out at me that I thought I would read to you as part of this talk. The empty, delusory body is the very body of the Dharma. Think about Yangshan standing with his hoe planted in the ground, his hands in a kind of shashu position. The empty delusory body, my body, your body, is the very body of the Dharma. When the Dharma body awakens completely, there is nothing at all. The source of our self nature is the Buddha of innocent truth. It struck me that Yangzhe could almost have been writing about this moment in the koan. And so how do we bring this into our practice together this weekend? How do we follow Yangshan's example here? And I think one way is to, as best as we can, doing our best, as we talked about last night, trying to bring our whole self into these activities that we do. For example, bowing to your seat when you come back into the Zendo. Or lifting your bowl at the end of the sutra service. Or taking the first step in Kinhin. All of these are ritualized actions. And the problem with ritualized actions is they can become rote, and we can fall into doing them mechanically. But what if we performed each of these actions with our whole selves? The way that Yangshan stands next to his hoe planted in the ground, revealing everything. How would you bow to your seat, fully exposed? How would you lift your bowl in a way that would be conveying the Dharma body that is your fragile, mortal human body? This is the invitation. This is the practice. Nothing less. We don't have to look at these great Chinese ancestors and think, yes, yeah, those were the days. That's when Zen was really great. Right now, right here, we can practice like this. So Guishan said, today many people are cutting reeds on South Mountain. Yangshan placed his hoe on his shoulder and immediately left. Last night, we began in silence, and then we did some activities together, and then we went back into silence. This morning, we began with tea and went into silence and did some activities and went back to silence, and now we're in another activity and going back to silence. And this follows the pattern of this koan. Activity to silence, to activity, silence to activity, to silence. This is our way. Sometimes we rest in these silent, unmoving practices. We embrace the stillness. We take advantage of each in-breath and each out-breath to fully be here, to fully study ourselves, to turn the light, to look within. And we might sit this way for several periods, and then we get up and we do something. We move into an activity. We don't stay stuck in silence. We don't stay stuck in activity. But we move from one to the other. We don't wish that Zazen kept going when it ends. We don't resent our Samu tasks. We don't wish that Zazen would stop before it ends, although I'll confess to you that there are times that I did when my legs hurt a lot, but we try not to. When we think we're done with our samu activity, we keep doing it. When there are more people here, sometimes that means you clean the bathroom and then you clean it again. We do what we do wholeheartedly and with our whole selves, and then we move to the next task. Stillness, activity, activity, stillness. In one of the koans, a teacher says, who among you at bottom is willing to live and die like this? I think this is another pointer for us. Who among us, who among you at bottom is willing to live and die like this? Guishan asked Yangshan, where have you been? Yangshan said, in the rice field. How many people are in the rice field? Yangshan thrust his hoe into the ground and stood with his hands clasped at his chest. Guishan said, today many people are cutting reeds on South Mountain. Yangshan placed his hoe on his shoulder and immediately left. Thank you. So please sit comfortably and we'll move into our rough oval shape. And please come forward with your questions, with your comments, and David and Melissa and I will try to answer. Ray?
So the first thought that came to mind when the question was asked, you know, how many people are in the field? My automatic response was no one and everyone. Mm. So that sense. And so then became, well, how do you manifest that? Then that was his particular manifestation of that koan, that question. And then I thought about what you were saying about the movement from stillness to activity. And for me, it's about stillness pervading the activity, no difference between the two. You know, so one feeds the other. And practice is not stopped. In other words, when activity begins, but how to bring the two together.
Yeah, and that's how every opposition works in Zen, right? Yeah. Form is exactly emptiness. Emptiness is exactly form. So, absolutely. So our stillness is not inert. Our stillness has great activity in it. And our activity is not frenetic. Right. Our activity has a kind of stillness in it. And that's part of what we love about the online sesshin, you know, as we move in and out of practicing together in stillness and then doing our ordinary lives in our ordinary ways and finding ways, as you said, to let them interpenetrate.
And also your comments and, you know, we do use language, right? Mm-hmm. And whenever we use any kind of language, it's inherently dualistic. So you can only talk about form and emptiness and the interpenetration of form and emptiness. But in your actual ringing of a bell or taking a step, there isn't any of that, which is one of the reasons this koan's so beautiful as a pointer, away from all the talking, away from, I mean, we do talk, right? We give talks. You're going to hear three more talks during session. And to watch how the mind keeps making that narration of meaning and then put it down and just keep going. You know, do what needs to be done.
So the manifestation of stillness, if you will, or narrow nature, whatever, is in the activity. And like they did, he, Prince Kumarpo, he did, you know, we talked about what he did, the activity that he did. But what was he manifesting? Is
But even to say, even to talk too much about it is a problem.
Yeah.
That's, right? Because you're trying to put words on it, and there's something when you are just ringing the bell, when you're just walking, it isn't form and emptiness together. It isn't a Zen activity. It is ding. Right, and you know that, and so we can't fully explain whatever it is we're doing, but you're exactly right in pointing something so alive and vast and mysterious going on all the time.
Yeah, and we have to be honest about our own minds. You know, think about Yangshan. Maybe he was narrating to himself. He was saying, okay, let's see, I just got a question. Oh, all right, I'm going to put my hoe in the ground and then I'm going to stand here. All that narration is extra. I doubt that he did it, but many of us do it. Right? We tell these endless stories about ourselves to remind ourselves to do things. There's a freedom in not having to tell that story about what I'm doing anymore.
Thank you, Rick.
Thank you,
Rick. Will.
Thank you for the talk. I'm wondering about one's head sticking out the back door wagging. Could you read that part again?
Sure. Yeah, so... saluting in front of the gate, walking down the hallway, this has a reason. What about dancing in the garden or wagging the head out the back door? So, Will, why did that appeal to you?
I don't know if I could really explain it. You don't you have to ask.
I'm waiting for you to go out the door.
I know. It seems like it would be rude during our dialogue. But, so, I think actually in fastening on that, I was kind of sticking my head out the back door and, you know, wagging a little bit.
Yeah, and what activity can't be a full manifestation of our Buddha nature?
Yeah, I think that's what I liked about it. I mean, even with the dance, I mean, you know, that's great too, and a wonderful image. But, you know, we think of dance as an art, right? So there could be something special about it. But I don't think anybody thinks of wagging your head out the back door as an art, so I really liked that it was included.
The other place I go with that is that there's so many parts of us, and sometimes we think, well, I'm only going straight. Mm-hmm. But there's always some part that's wagging its head out the back door, trying to check up and make sure. And all of that gets included. So it's not, oh, you must be pure. Never look back. Never talk about. Right? Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Look what's happening out there. Yeah. All included.
Thank you.
And too, there's a way of dancing that isn't a refined art.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
There's a free way of dancing. Just like enjoying your life and your body and moving it. So I love that line, particular line, for that reason, too. All right. Yeah. Okay. Bowing to my cushion and ringing the bells. Right. And also, woohoo! Everything's included. Everybody's been saying.
In the garden, I saw pictures of dancing with the hoe.
Yeah. Well, that'd be kind of cool.
It makes me think of the koan where the teacher comes in for lunch with the rice and does a little dance and says, little bodhisattvas, come and get your rice.
I think there's a famous Fred Astaire dance where he dances with a broom. Mm-hmm. And that's his part.
Thank you, Will. Yes, Paul.
Yeah, I was really attracted to this aspect of Baijan having his monastery up and away from all that political intrigue. Mm-hmm. And I do have a very old dream of being that mountain monk and hermit. I used to think that Zen was going to let me do that. And then I come to Sesshin, I was like, oh, this is exactly what, you know, I'm pulling back. it can be further from the truth. Mm-hmm. You know, I really do come here and have this time to practice because I'm out there. I really want to be engaged. Mm-hmm. I have to take this backward step. I have to, as far as have this time with Sangha and support this, practicing alone together with this full intention of walking out this temple door and engaging. Even in the, ancient China, there was still the pilgrimage and walking to the villages and the marketplaces and, maybe shutting out a little bit. And I have some filters around the news as such. And really want to keep showing up in this world. Mm-hmm. And each and every one of us has to.
Yeah, and this is the Bodhisattva way.
Yeah.
Right, again, beings are numberless.
Yeah, yeah.
But we're not going to save them if we stay away from them.
Yeah.
Yeah, and even, if we imagine a monastic situation where someone never leaves the monastery, there are Bodhisattvas. And there are beings to be saved,
yeah,
and bodhisattvas to save them right there.
Yeah.
There's also this, indefinable part of it, which James Ford used to talk about, the third founding teacher of Boundless Way Zen, who is, when I say he's no longer with us, I mean he's in California.
Yeah.
But he liked to say that. And he said this with such great conviction that it convinced me, even though I don't fully understand it. He used to say that we can't underestimate what our Zazen activity does for the world.
Yeah.
Just the Zazen activity, without stepping back out the door.
Mm-hmm.
Something is happening here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, and then we go into where Ray started us with the alternating in and out, but no alternation.
Mm-hmm.
When we sit a period of Zazen, we sit for our whole life,
right,
not just for 25 minutes. It may have felt like that sometimes, right? But it's true. And then we live our whole life walking, following will, trying to catch up to will, and then everything included.
Well, I love, the temple being where it is, right,
yeah,
in the middle of a city, buses going by, plows this morning, somebody's alarm going off forever. These things might disturb us because there's a purity that we sometimes are looking for.
Right.
You actually do live on Snow Mountain.
I do, yeah.
Right? That's part of it. Some of you may not know that if you're a priest, you're not allowed to go to the bathroom wearing your robes.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was going to the bathroom during Kinhin earlier, I was standing in the Doksan room looking out on the back. And it takes a long time to take it off and put it on, at least for me. I'm not that facile.
Okay.
But as I was standing there, putting on each piece of the robe and seeing the brick pathways and the Buddha figures and the sculptors and the gazebo, I remembered why we came here.
Mm-hmm.
Because for me, it has this quality of both,
yeah,
without even having to mention it.
Right.
Right. A real Buddhist temple in the middle of a city.
Right.
And for me, it all came together as like planting the hoe,
right,
except it was like the inner robe, the outer robe, the belts, that. Each thing, and then the world offering itself to me as what I saw at the window.
Yeah.
So this is the promise, in a way, of this practice, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
We don't have to think about it too hard.
Mm-hmm.
But we do need to live it as fully as possible in every moment.
Who else? Yeah, Anne.
I was interested in that relationship of, when you change activity, what was it that you seemed to like easily release, like, okay, you know, you say that there's work this other place, I'll just go, or so I think that a lot of that in life where something arises and you have to be flexible to change what you're doing.
Yes.
And it seemed also kind of like without any defensiveness, like mm-hmm. planting the stick in, well, yeah, like what's next or what have mm-hmm. I been doing, you know, that openness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a beautiful moment, isn't it, when mm-hmm. he picks up the implement mm-hmm. and puts it on his shoulder and walks away. That's just what you're describing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And nobody had to reassure anybody else, like, oh yeah, we had a really good interchange now, I'm going to say goodbye, but a kind of presentation of just this,
yes.
and just this, and this possibility of living that way. Yeah.
And I think, again, that the ordinary way that we change activities, there's a leaking, or lingering, right, of the previous activity. It's very hard to do what Yangshan demonstrated.
Yes.
Yeah. Because, yeah, you understand.
And also know, well, you know, I was just working in the rice field.
Right.
Now I'm supposed to go and cut cake. Come on.
I really wanted to just work in the rice field, okay?
Yeah. Why are you asking this?
We've all been there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Why don't we end there? Please restore the Zendo.